Everybody, welcome to episode 3 of The Top Shelf. Our guest today is DHH, and we talk about a wide variety of topics, and we get right into it here. Prime has actually just asked DHH what's the thing that he's most proud of, but of course somehow Prime is most proud of pressing the record button approximately 5 seconds after asking the question. So you'll pick up in mid-response from him. But we are off to the races. Thanks, everybody, and I hope you enjoy episode 3 of The Top Shelf.
Well, the only reason I can really do this is because I get to set my own technical direction. I could pick whatever I wanted for this project. A lot of people sort of have to eat. And at the time, at least, they didn't get to eat and eat Ruby at the same time or program Ruby at the same time. And after Rails, that was possible. And it is possible now, still 20 years later, and I think that is something I'm quite proud of, to have donated to programmers at large that you can both eat and write Ruby at the same time. That's amazing.
What made you pick Ruby out of all the different options at the time? Because that is, it's kind of unique. I wouldn't put Ruby as one of the most popular ones, but it was definitely one that I had to go study at one point in college as like a interesting dynamic language.
Yeah, it definitely wasn't popular when I picked it up, but Martin Fowler and Dave Thomas, two highly esteemed programmers that I was following at the time, were writing about Ruby, using Ruby to write about programming concepts in IEEE magazine and a few other outlets, and both of them were doing quite a good job at sort of just showing what it was like. And I remember reading that one of those first articles going like, is this a programming language or are they just writing pseudocode? Because this looks too good. This looks suspiciously good. Like, where the fuck are all the semicolons? Where are all the line noise that I'm used to in basically every other programming language ever? And I just didn't, like, this is just really curious. And it awakened in me just that desire for peak aesthetics. Because I'd been working with PHP, I'd been working with some Perl, I'd done a bit of Python, I'd done a fair bit of Java, I'd done a lot of other programming language, all fine in their own regard. But when I saw Ruby, I saw something different. And I thought that was really interesting. And then the other thing I would credit Ruby with is after I dove in, Ruby really taught me metaprogramming. And that's one of those defining moments when you realize, oh, a program can program itself. That is really next level. Like, it takes your understanding of what programming is to a higher point. And I think whoever teaches you that first, that next level, that next tier, you're going to have some degree of a bond with. And I certainly developed a bond with Ruby. And then I also just thought, you know what? Why not? Like, if I like how this looks, I like what it's teaching me. I like how it feels to be a programmer writing this programming language. Why would I not pick it? Why would I even care whether it's popular or not popular, whether other people like it or they don't like it? At least at the time, and I'd say probably still, I didn't really mind the fact that there wasn't a lot of tooling, that there wasn't a lot of frameworks, there weren't a lot of libraries, because you know what? I could just write it myself. Now, that's not entirely true. I mean, Ruby obviously did have a fair number of libraries and frameworks. They didn't have as many as it does now, and it didn't have as many as other languages did, but it had enough. I think there is some basis where a new program language comes out, then there's literally nothing. There's just the primitives. That's a tough hill to climb, I think. But Ruby wasn't like that. There was just enough that I felt like I could bootstrap what I wanted to do off that and get going really fast. I mean, I didn't go away in a cave spending 5 years meditating on Ruby to come up with Rails. It was basically like 2 weeks, and I had some HTML talking to a database, and just the early inklings of what Rails was going to be came about pretty quick. And then just a couple months into it, the shape of Rails as it exists today was visible. So that's also part of it. That was part of the appeal for me about Ruby, that Ruby wasn't just any other programming language. It was a programming language that kind of super turbocharged everything I was doing. And I was able to create results much quicker than I had with any other programming language. And some of that, I think, is inherent in Ruby. I think it is a highly productive programming language. But part of it was also just my reaction to the programming language. Like, when you find something that just really fits and you want to use it all the time. In photography, they have this saying, well, one saying, the best camera is the one you have with you. And the other saying is, the best camera is the one that makes you want to go out and take photos. Ruby made me want to go out and do programming, or go in and do programming as it is. And I think that part of it was a huge push for my career, that I just went from, oh, I've been doing programming mostly because I wanted the programs, like I wanted the output. Now I found a place, I found a programming language where I just want to do the programming, where the programming itself is the reward. Now I still pursue programs. It's not like I'm just writing katas or whatever for the sheer joy of it, but there is a sheer joy in the act of programming with Ruby. I hadn't felt that. I hadn't seen that in any other programming language. And in the early days, I thought this is totally unique to Ruby. Like, this is a property of Ruby. This is how Ruby makes programmers feel like they are superheroes in this way, and therefore everyone should use Ruby. And I spent quite a few years earnestly trying to persuade as many people as I possibly could that they should all use Ruby all the time for everything, certainly within web development. And it took me a little longer to figure out, do you know what? That feeling I have to Ruby, other people have to other languages. And that is the lion's share of the superpower. Now, again, I actually think there's a there too, that Ruby itself is intrinsically more productive and allows us to do things and certainly aesthetically more pleasing. But the larger chunk of it is helping programmers find that experience I found with Ruby. And you know what? If they find that in PHP, or if they find it in Python and they find it in Elixir or whatever, wonderful. I'm so happy for you. That is really the main progression point. And it took a while for me to discover that. But even having had discovered that, I kept looking over the past 25 years I've been programming, 20 some years since Ruby. Could I find another Ruby? Because I always thought, like, all right, if I was doing, say, PHP, and then I find Ruby, and I go like, holy shit, this is so much better. I'm so much more productive. I'm so much happier doing it. Could I find another thing that would have that same feeling beyond Ruby? And I just never did. And I came to the realization in part, like, the world isn't that large. We think of, like, oh my God, there's an unlimited number of programming languages. No, there's not. I mean, how many have there ever been made? 1,000, maybe? How many have ever been used really in anger? 50? How many are currently viable options that most people would consider today for web programming? 10? 20? Like, it's not that many. You can actually survey the world, and you'll find that, like, it's a sphere, and you can get to the other side, and you've been all the way around. And then you can look at all those options and go, which one is the one that creates that connection for me? And for me, it was just, it not just was, but is Ruby. That after having sampled pretty much all of it, and I like sampling, right? Like, I like going to, just like I like to travel, I like to go to Japan. I'm like, oh, this is a foreign culture. They're totally different. Everything is different. That's what's wonderful about it. And then also, I'm glad I'm home. And that's what Ruby feels to me. I'll go explore some other environment. Sometimes I have to do it. Like, we could talk about JavaScript perhaps later. You just sort of, I need it, right? I need it to do some things that Ruby won't let me do. And then I go like, oh, this is great. This is a wonderful little vacation here. And then I come back to Ruby and I go like, holy shit, this is good to be home. What was the question?
First off, you answered everything you needed to answer. That was, if there is any piece of advice, any programmer ever needs to hear, it's the programming, it's the side project, it's the experiment you're running that's going to make you want to do it again tomorrow. It's probably, like, single-handedly the thing that's going to make so many people's lives change. And I just, man, from the bottom of my heart, I love that. That is, like, that is my mantra in life.
And you know what's funny? This used to be a big theme. I remember in the mid-2000s, both Ruby was advancing this because that's intrinsic to the language. Literally, Matt's is motto for Ruby is optimized for programmer happiness. So that makes it pretty explicit. But plenty of other environments were following this at the time. And then I think we fell into a bit of a bad way in the 2010s, when suddenly it almost became a little dirty to say that you liked programming or that programmers should be passionate. In fact, that was somehow almost discriminatory to people who hate their jobs. And I was like, wait, that seems like not a right angle here. I totally understand that you can be gainfully employed doing programming as a job and not want to do it like 24/7 outside of that. Fine, okay. But also, like, it's easier if you like it. It's easier if it's just enjoyable. It's easier if you want to do it most of the time. And I will say, a few programs I've met have not at least had a phase where that's been true if they were to arrive at some point of notoriety, that they contributed something to the community, they built something. Not a lot of programmers, I would say, who are just like on the 9-to-5 thing ended up doing that. Now, that's also fine. Like, whatever, we have millions of programmers. Do they all need to create things all the time? Maybe not. But again, I don't think that reality is actually something to celebrate. And it's a little bit like that fucking dog, that meme with the dog, I don't know what the fuck I'm doing, that I just absolutely hate and loathe even. This idea that knowing things, getting better at things, being competent is somehow, that doesn't exist, right? And where I remember that discourse was a lot about programmers who I knew things, feigning that they didn't. And that was the kind of bullshit that I just went like, oh, calm the fuck on. I don't know everything. I'm totally happy to admit ignorance on a wide variety of topics. But also, I do know some things about some of the things that I do. That's why I do them. That's why I get paid to do them. That's why there's impact from it and so forth. So let's not fall into this trap that no one fucking knows anything, that competence doesn't exist, and actually the highest calling is just to have a fucking 9-to-5 that you don't really like because reasons.
Yeah, I think one of the, like, for me, it's not only a bad meme because it sort of throws away, like, all the things that you've learned, and, like, clearly, like, if you were going to make a website in Ruby on Rails and I was going to write one in, like, C, like, I think you would be done first, and there's something, like, important about that trade-off. But I also think it really, like, misleads juniors and people entering the industry because their end goal now is like, oh, my end goal is I don't have to know anything, never have to struggle to learn anything, never have to overcome and accomplish anything to get to mastery. Look at all these people I respect who have shipped valid things, who have done awesome stuff, and they're just saying, well, I don't know anything. You're like, no, you do. You're lying to them. You're tricking them. You're putting them on the wrong path.
That's 100% it. And to me, it's almost like a kind of luxury belief. By the time you've reached some competence that is marketable and you can actually use it to get a job and so on, you feigning that, like, it doesn't really matter, everyone looks everything up on the internet, whatever, just pushing it so far out that you're demeaning competence as a valuable virtue to pursue, it's a luxury good. Like, you're not paying the penalty for that. Right. The people who embrace it and think that they can just ask AI for everything, or they can just look everything up, but they don't have to understand the copy pasta that they slam into the project, they're the ones who are going to suffer, because they're the ones who are going to have their career prospects curbed, right? And that's what gets me is at the beginning of that whole trajectory of that narrative, I was actually on board. I was on board in as far as to say, do you know what? We should make it a lot easier for people to get started. There's no fucking reason it has to be that difficult that you have to spend literally days before you get to Hello World. That was the whole premise of early Rails. I had been working in a Java shop. I saw what happened when we started a new project, that someone had to go off for a fucking week to do XML sit-ups just so we could have whatever the Spring configuration that we needed for our web app server something. And I just went like, this is stupid. This does not need to be like this. This is actually a sign of lack of sophistication. We can solve this problem. We can solve the initial trajectory or angle of the curve, and we can soften it a lot such that people who are not already trained wizards in XML systems can come in and get the Hello World dopamine hit. To me, that there's so much that is just bound up in that. Can you do a thing and then see a thing? If you can get into that loop, you're well on the way to become a programmer. But far too many environments, certainly at the time, and I argue still so, we've recreated some of that madness, especially in the JavaScript world, where it had to be difficult, right? And we mistook that like the early difficulty is actually somehow that's where the competence and the mastery is. No, fucking no. That's just the boilerplate shit that we're setting up. But then paths diverge, right? I was all about let's making the ramp soft so that we can keep going. And I want you to have a 10-year career constantly getting better, constantly learning more things, constantly getting more competent, just that by the end of it, you're going to look like a fucking god to your former self. Like, that's the value of it. Like, we can make the computer do all these things, and we can make him do it because we understand things, right? The ramp needs to be soft, but it needs to go to infinity.
Yeah, and I think something that, and I think we'll probably come back to this when we talk about NeoVim. I know Prime wants to hit a few things before we go, like, deep onto NeoVim, because I think between the three of us, we may accidentally, like, forget to go eat dinner and just talk about NeoVim for 12 hours. So we'll like hold off on that. But one of the things that I think is important in what you were saying is like that aspect of getting a dopamine hit along the path of learning. And I think it's really undervalued, and it's also undervalued in sort of like the tooling or the syntax or the result or some other way that like whatever it is that you're doing can surprise you to motivate you to learn the next thing. Right. And like, when you're thinking on a time scale of my career, right? Not like this week, but my career, you need some like positive reinforcement to come back to make you feel good. So the next time you sit down in front of the computer, it's a happy place. It's not Pavlov's dog in like getting, you know, a sad consequence, but oh, I'm ready to eat, you know? And I think that aspect is so missed by a lot of people thinking in this longer time horizon.
And I think that is something I knew so well because I tried to learn programming 3 times and failed earlier as I was younger. I wanted programming because I wanted to make games and wanted to, and I just couldn't get it because the initial thing, it wasn't a curve, it was a step function. And there was no one there to give me a fucking hand and pull me up. So I just didn't get it. And I just gave up. So by the time I rolled around to Ruby on Rails, I was like, you know what? We're not going to make it this. We're going to make it soft and we're going to get people on board, but then we're going to keep going, right? So I'll take the dog, doesn't know anything. Great. That's your first day. That's your first day. But in a year from now, you can't be that fucking dog. You can't be a copy pasta monkey who doesn't know what you're inserting. At least some of the time you have to pull the thread and try to understand what the fuck is going on. Because it just becomes more enjoyable too. You have far more agency when you understand what you're working with, the tools and the materials and all of it. And then you go like, yeah, do you know what? I'm stumped. I'm stumped all the time. Every programmer is. We hit a bug. It seems like magic. But then we go like, there is no magic. There's just fucking sand shoved together into silicon. And that's the chip. And it's going to be logical. I just don't understand it yet. And right now it seems like magic. I'll just keep cracking at it. And in the end, you'll figure it out. And you go like, yeah, it wasn't magic. It was that thing. And having the developing, the stamina and the perseverance to do that is just crucial because it's only going to accelerate. The more we get the fucking AI slob in that just like spewing shit at us that we sort of barely understand, we shove it in, right? The more or the easier it almost becomes to just embrace that dog. I don't know what the fuck I'm doing. I'm a prompt engineer now. Like, I want you to be ready. I want you to be ready with some basic virtues and tactics for figuring shit out. Because it applies not just to programming. I've applied that principle of a programmer's mind, I'm going to figure things out, to about 1 million other domains. I've had bugs in my house with my ventilation system. And I go like, ooh, this is curious. I don't understand why it's doing these things. But if I figure all the things out, oh, here are the variables. I can clarify there's 5 of those. It's a closed loop system. We're not getting the optimization. This is great. You just become a more capable human when you learn to understand things and develop competence. And having seen the cycle a few times, I mean, race car driving is another example I often use, is I went into race car driving quite late in my life. We're competing against kids who've been go-karting since they were 6 years old. I had to figure out that system and figure out, like, what are the main moving levers? How do I go faster? What's the main thing? Oh, it's the brake trace. It has to look like a squiggly thing when I'm in this car, and when I'm in this car, it has to look like a table braking. And just diagnosing all that, it was the same fundamental sort of human inquiry principles I was applying in programming. So as you develop those in programming, you get them for the rest of your life. I mean, that's the other thing. This isn't just an investment in fucking whatever JavaScript framework du jour that transfers nothing to your rest of your life. If you approach this as like competence is important, understanding things is important, pulling the thread is important, sometimes struggling a bit is important, these are skills you take forward. And they just make everything better. They make everything faster. They make everything more fun. It is just more fun to be competent.
Yeah, I published a like a thing about this a little while ago, and I think Prime will probably echo this idea too, that like in sort of the like preface to the argument, I said, suppose AI can write all of the code possible in the future. Is it like still today worth thinking about and learning code? And for exactly the same argument, my case was like, yes, today you can pay your bills with code. It's like, that's good. And all of the skills you get, even if they don't, even if like I learn a bunch of things about OCaml mentioned, right? It's like, I can still take that thinking, the brain muscles that I'm learning, the way of solving problems, decomposing it into smaller things. I can just use that same thing for whatever the next task is when AI writes all of my code for me. And I think that's really underappreciated as well in the programming space.
Hugely.
Yeah. Okay, so I have to hear about this. So you tried to learn programming three times. Now, I'm pretty sure that nobody in this chat thought at any one point you struggled learning programming. Yeah, here you are admitting, hey, I actually struggled learning programming. I've seen this a lot of times that when people meet their heroes, they end up saying something along the lines of, oh, yeah, actually, I struggled on this thing. And it just feels like a world rocker. Why did you struggle, I guess, with programming, especially three separate times?
Well, part of it was the environment in which I tried to learn it. Like now, and I'm going to sound really old, right? Like things were difficult back in my day.
They were.
The first time I tried to learn programming was literally like 1985 or 86. I was like 5 or 6 years old. I really liked video games and I wanted to figure out, could I do something myself? And there were these magazines print on like dead trees that would come out. And in the back of the magazine, like literally code listings would be there. And you could type in the code listings, like just the lines. And I'd spent like an hour and a half typing that shit in and like something wasn't right and it wouldn't work. And I tried at that early phase to like, could I figure it out? Which is sort of a good encapsulating, like I was no fucking savant, right? Like at 6, 7 years old, I'm not getting it. Then again, I tried it like, I don't know, 12 or 13. This was EC Amos. I remember a little bit more about this. And I remember thinking, what's the point of a variable? Like, why do you want to change it? Like, if I just wrote that it was 5, there's just some basics of programming I just couldn't grasp. And I think part of it was there really wasn't a lot of help, I'd say. I mean, you could get some books, you could get some magazines. There was no Stack Overflow. There was no Google. There was none of these other things. There was no AI. So I didn't get it. And then I tried, or I sort of looked into it once more when I was like about 15, 16. I had a bunch of programmer friends at that time who were all deep into assembler programming. And I looked at that for about 5 minutes and went like, whoosh. I remember thinking like, wait, I got to do vector math to do fucking games programming. Yeah, okay, I'm out. I'm not doing vector math. That's just not my forte. So it wasn't until, I mean, I guess I was like 20 years old or something like that, when I'd been working with the web for some time. I'd sort of been doing some HTML, some CSS. And then around 2000, I helped develop a gaming website called dailyrush.dk. And I sort of just nibbled at it. I had a couple of programmer friends I was working on the project with me, and we were writing in PHP. And I just kept like helping out. And then I help out a little more. And it really, it clicked in a different way because there was actual real programmers on the project. So if I fucked something up or it didn't work, there was someone to ask. There was someone to help. There was some other code to look at. And then it kind of started to click. And yeah, it was just a slow ramp. I wish I'd learned programming when I was 12. I would have liked to play those games, whatever the hell they would have been. That would have been fun. But it wasn't really until I found the right level of abstraction for me. And the right level of abstraction for me is not vector programming. I have accepted that fact. I'm not going to be a games programmer. I'm not going to write a 3D engine. That's just not where I thrive. I thrive at a level of abstraction where it's more about concepts, words, picking the right things. That's why Ruby was so appealing to me, because after you boil away almost all the line noise that most programming languages have, you're left with essentially a form of English, like a very regimented form of English, but also Ruby, not that regimented. Like Ruby allowed sort of all these alternatives where, oh, you could do whatever command unless condition. What the fuck? You've changed the, isn't the if supposed to come first? And then there's supposed to be a not, and then there's supposed to be a condition, and then you do the thing. Ruby to me was just blowing my mind by the flexibility it had. And that was what helped accelerate things where I'm like, oh, I'm actually good at that part. I can't do the vector math stuff, but I can do this stuff. I can build information systems. I can do object-oriented programming. I know object-oriented programming have sort of fallen a little bit out of vogue at the frontier here. Like, oh, functional programming. Like, that's the thing. Like, no, I'm an object-oriented programmer through and through. I like functional programming paradigms. I like aspects of it. I like shoving that into my little grubby objects. But as a way of thinking about the world, I love object-oriented programming. That really just made sense to me. I could see whole systems. I could see all the elements. I could see domain models. And then I can have some functional programming elements into it. But I don't see like functions and data separate. So that helped me too. Just object-oriented programming, high-level programming languages like Ruby, and then information technology. What were we creating? For some reason, I don't know why. Like, why do these things happen? I just really like CRUD. Like, I like dealing with a database. Like, often it sounds disparaging. Oh, you're just making another fucking to-do list. Yeah, that's the internet. The internet is just a fucking collection of people making to-do lists. That is CRUD apps, right? Almost everything on the internet is some fucking database getting inserts, updates, writes, and deletes. That's what it is. Let's just embrace it with joy and go like, yes, that's what I do. I fucking hammer on a database all day long. I shape it into little blocks and it can make virtually everything that exists on the internet. That's pretty damn incredible. I mean, it's not games programming. I kind of wish I was a games programmer. That is significantly more rock and roll than making another to-do app. I will accept that. But hey, you gotta work with the blessings you've got. And that's the blessing I got, object-oriented programming at a high level in Ruby. Okay, that's my cards. That's my flush. Play it.
It's so funny that you say that because I don't know what it is about programmers and this look of game programming, but I think every last one of us that couldn't keep up with actual game programming, like, man, you know, if one day I know that I could be that guy if I just tried hard enough. I know I could.
I know I couldn't. And you know why? I just tried recently. And so I think about a year ago or something, I took some time off. And I was like, do you know what? That dream about games programming, maybe I was just too young. Maybe I'm so much smarter now. And I sat down like, let's start with something simple. And I picked up like Commodore 64 assembler code. Like there's actually a great community, people making new Commodore 64 games. I'm like, that's got to be the simplest possible thing. Here we're emulating literally a CPU with 1 megahertz. One, not two, not three, 1 megahertz. So how hard can it be? I mean, I could almost probably keep up with that CPU if I was running real fast, right? Like how many instructions per second can you execute with 1 fucking megahertz? So I sit down and I start like, all right, crack the knuckles. Let's get going here. I'm going to do some game programming. And I lasted about fucking 45 minutes until I'm like, yeah, oh shit, this is why. Yeah, this is not me. I cannot do that thing. And you know what it reminded me about? So I talk about race cars, and I really like cars, right? I like driving, and like all this stuff. And then I thought, I've multiple times thought, well, maybe boats. Maybe boats are also fun. Like there's the ocean. I like the ocean. I like looking at the ocean. And every fucking single time I go out in a boat, it takes about 15 minutes before I go, yeah, I'm not into boats. Like I like the image of boats. I like the idea of wind in your hair and salt water in your face kind of thing. But that's just not me. I want to get back to shore. And that's what I felt when I went into this Commodore 64 tutorial. I'm just like, yeah, I got to get back to shore. Like, I got to get some Ruby into these fucking fingers again because this isn't me. I can't do the MUV, the thing, the XORs, all the stuff.
I'm surprised you didn't try out something like Dragon Ruby. I don't know if you've heard of it. It's a game engine in Ruby. So you might want to check that one out. That might be a little bit. Yeah.
Do you know what, though? I think it's not the syntax. That's not my problem. My problem is the actual domain, right? And a lot of it is about its collision detection, its math, its things. And it's like, yeah, that's just not – I mean, I willfully flunked my high school math final year because at the beginning of the year, I remember getting the first assignment and I went like, this is too much fucking work. Like I got other things I want to do with my life. I can't do this. So I made a deal with a buddy in my class like, hey, can I just copy your homework the entire year? It's fine. I'll just introduce some bugs in it so it doesn't look too obvious. And I just did that. And I arrived at the final point where we had to take the exam. And I was like, do you know what? I could probably wing it. You only need 26% correct to not get an F. at least in my school. I was like, that's got to be possible. And I just realized, no, it's not fucking possible. Math is very unforgiving. You don't fucking know it. You can't do it. There's not like, oh, I'm going to figure it out in the exam room here. Like, I just, the integral equations here, they're just going to come to me through divine intervention. No, they're not. And then I learned, you know what? That's not true of all domains. I went to my exam in, like, in English. I'm originally from Denmark, and I went to my exam in Danish. And the Danish one is the best one. So I walk in, and you draw your question, right? Like, this is what you're going to get examined on. And I draw fucking, I don't know, middle age poetry or something. And I go like, I don't know fucking anything about this. I don't remember anything about it at all. I walk into the exam room. You've got 20 minutes to prepare. I open this book, and there's like a checklist of like the five factors you should look at. Oh, the magic. Anyway, whatever, right? Then I walk into the fucking exam room, and I just start like bullshitting at 200 miles an hour. Like so fast, they didn't even have a chance to interject the question. And there's only 15 minutes of examination. And as you might have realized by now, I could fucking talk for 15 minutes without letting anyone get another word in. And I'm like, boom, A plus. Boom. I was like, I got to find a way to commercialize this aspect of what I'm good at. Not the fucking math part. Now a lot of people go like, oh, that makes sense. That's why Ruby and Rails is so fucking slow. And like, yes, to some degree, yes. But also to some degree, not, because by the time Ruby and Rails got off the ground, I did happen to attract enough people into the big tent of this who actually did like math, right? And who didn't fucking flunk their high school thing because they thought it was too much work. And they made it better. And I think this is what's so wonderful about open source. You can show up and you go like, I am good at these two things. Do anyone want to trade? I can make these parts, and then you make the other parts, and then we put our parts together, and it's more than the sum. That's really nice. That's really great. Ruby on Rails is as good as it is, as fast as it is, used in as many high-profile places as it is, because literally like 7,000 people contributed code to the code base. I wasn't going to do all that shit on my own. I mean, I was going to make the to-do list work on my own, but I wasn't going to make Shopify do a million requests a second on my own, right? That needed some of the math folks to come in and assist.
Yeah, speaking of open source, something that I really resonated with from your writing is talking about how open source isn't a community or a democracy, right? It's a gift exchange. I don't know if you want to sort of elaborate on that idea, because I really, so I'm a core maintainer of NeoVim. I wrote Telescope and a bunch of other stuff. So like, I definitely, when I read that, I was like, yes, give it up for DHH on that one. NeoVim, by the way, yes, chat. I know you're already going to spam it. That's fine. But go ahead. Take us away on sort of that that aspect.
Yeah. So what's really interesting about open source is it has sort of the shape and the outline as something that seems democratic, which is a fundamental mistake of analysis. It's not democratic at all. It is meritocratic. It is absolutely that. Now, that also went through a phase. That word, meritocratic, went to a phase where it was in the doghouse for about 5 years or something. I think it's safe to take it out of the doghouse now. Meritocratic processes are good. And merit in open source is about as pure of a distillation of merit as I've seen anywhere. Like, you go into corporate and like, you know what? Companies try to be meritocratic, but there's also about 500 other concerns that weigh on why your career goes the way it does. And it's not always just the smartest, most capable person that gets ahead. In open source, it's kind of both, mostly is. The person who shows up and does most of the work in the best way possible typically ends up having the most say, and that's good. It's not democratic. It's not like everyone sits around in the circle and like, let's vote who should get the say on where this project goes. And then they fucking pick Joe because Joe's really good at advocating for a platform. Fuck Joe. Joe's not going to have anything to say unless Joe is the person writing the goddamn code. Like, that's actually what you want. You want the most capable, competent people who are doing the goddamn work to set the direction. And that is something that I think programmers with one side of their brain probably accept most of the time. And then they have this other side of the brain that gets carried away with the idea of like a kumbaya circle where no one has power of authority or whatever. And yeah, no projects that have ever reached any notoriety have been driven in that way. All the things we so dearly respect, everything from Linux to SQLite to NeoVim to Ruby on Rails to Ruby itself to every single fucking project, there's someone at the top who does the bulk of the work and sets the direction of where things go, and that's good. And then there's a bunch of shit that never goes anywhere where it's just a goddamn circle jerk. So meritocratic notions are really important, but they're also inherently controversial, because in it is a statement, usually unsaid because it's not that polite, where we go like, do you know what? My opinion is worth more than your opinion. And it's worth more because I've done the work and I know the work, and you just fucking showed up in a GitHub issues trying to tell me how to do my fucking job. And like, no, no, go fuck yourself. That's not how it's going to work. And maybe this is where the stream crossing comes in with the whole JavaScript question, because this was on the grand scale, this played out when we yanked TypeScript out of Turbo, a front-end library that worked on for many years. We yanked it out like last year, and a bunch of people showed up to tell me like whether that was the correct decision. And usually they showed up to say it was not the correct decision, right? And you just go like, who the fuck are you? You just showed up from a link on Twitter to tell someone who's actually been working on this for fucking years how they should be working. No, no. So to me, this goes all the way back to literally the first presentation I gave on Rails after it was out was at a conference in Canada. And my fourth or fifth slide was a big black and white slide that just said, fuck you. And it was addressed directly to that kind of commentary that already at that point, I mean, Rails had been released for literally 3 months before people started showing up demanding how I spent my time. Oh, Rails doesn't do Oracle database connections yet. Get on it. What? I'm not your fucking vendor. I'm not your employee. I am the bearer and bringer of gifts. And you will either take those gifts and be at least slightly grateful, or if not grateful, at least shut the fuck up. And if you don't want to do those things, if you don't want to be either grateful or shut the fuck up, you're going to get this. And you know what? That's a proportionate response to your ass foolery. So when I look at open source, I go like, do you know what? Open source is more fun when we are courteous and kind and not full of this all the time. But occasionally, you got to have the hammer, right? Like walk softly, but carry a big stick. I like to walk softly most of the time. And occasionally, someone needs a fucking whack on the head where they're just reminded about the core dynamics and now how they should be. Because the other thing is, you don't want it any other way. You do not want your open source projects run by people who are not sort of the best at making them, who haven't put in the work, who haven't done all that. You don't want to nominate some random schmo to run it. That's just not going to get you the kind of software that you want. So my early day, once I got tired of just doing this and realizing, you know what, that's a little abrasive and some people take it the wrong way. Maybe I should calm down a little bit. I came up with a shorter version of it, which was PDI. Someone would go like, oh, you should do the Oracle adapter. And I'd be like, PDI, please do investigate. You fucking do it. You fucking do it. You want an Oracle adapter? Great. Submit the patch. I'll have a look at it. If the code is good, it's not overly complicated, it doesn't blow up all sorts of other things, I'll probably go like, that's great. Thank you very much. Now we've shared gifts. We could be friends. Let's hug and dance and do all the things. We're doing open source.
Yeah, I think a phrase that I always have liked from Justin, who's currently the sort of like dictator for NeoVim, is that users can be fired, right? This idea of like, you shouldn't be afraid to fire some of your users sometimes, especially given a lot of the constraints that you have, like as an open source project, right? Like constraints are good. And you know, I think directly quoting from some Basecamp stuff, there's never enough to go around, right? And so if you have some really squeaky wheels, sometimes, unfortunately, the best option is you say, like, you can do that. I'm totally fine. Also, the fork button is like a button and you can do that too. And that's good. But like for the betterment of like everybody else, we kind of got to move on from this issue and let me like actually ship the stuff that's going to push this forward.
That's usually the point where the power balance gets exposed, and that's where people get a little mad, because they think when we're having this discussion in a GitHub issue that like if they just make an argument that they think is good, it has as much weight or it has as much value as someone who's actually doing the work and carrying the project forward. And it just doesn't, right? Mm-hmm. Like you could even be right. I'm not even saying I'm right all the time. I mean, no one's right all the time. I'm wrong all the time. I change my mind all the time too. So sometimes people go like, you should do this. And I go like, no, you're an idiot. And then like literally next week, I'm like, holy shit, that was actually correct. I'm an idiot. So let's go back and fix it and let's sort it out. But it has to be that way. And it has to be sort of just accepted that those power dynamics are there. And not that they're there, but that they're good. And then this is the magic of open source is that, as you say, you can fork or you can just start your own project. So much of wonderful open source, including much that I've done over my years, have come from exactly that. I go to some project that I think is in the direction of what I want, and then I try to see if I can get it there, and I can't, because that's not where they want to go. They want to go somewhere else, and I go like, you know what? Fair enough. I'll do my own thing. I'll pack my own goddamn bags, and I'll set out on an adventure, and I'll create something different. I mean, the great story of Linus with Git is exactly that. What was the thing he was using?
BitKeeper. Something? They reverse engineered the BitKeeper protocol, which was strictly forbidden in their TOS. And they got evicted and had to write their own.
Yes. Yes, exactly. And how wonderful is that? Imagine if they had somehow worked it out with BitKeeper. We would have been without Git. We'd still have been fucking subversion everything. No, thank you. So some of this conflict and tension should not be seen as like a necessary or an evil. Mm-hmm. It's actually beneficial. It is in that grind. It is in that robbing. We realize we're not all the same. We don't want the same things. There shouldn't just be one project. There shouldn't just be one framework. There shouldn't just be one programming language. There should be a multitude of them. And you should gravitate towards the one that most closely resemble what you would like to see and what you would like to have. And this is why we need a bunch of choices. This is why we should not sort of just converge on five things, which I know the internet loves a horse race, right? Like there's always like, oh, is this framework more popular than that framework? Like they constantly want to converge. No. Don't converge. Have enough choices, have enough options to realize programmers are weird and wonderful in very idiosyncratic ways that are incompatible. You can't take all the people who write the fucking Go code and shove them into a Ruby project and then like they're going to be happy. That's not just, no. Like, we want different things. Actually, I mean, maybe Go is the wrong example. We have some folks on the team who do write Go, and I think they sort of like it okay, too. So, anyway, just this idea that there are different universes that have non-overlapping, conflicting visions of what they want. And clarifying those boundaries is helpful to get people to realize what they want. Now, the first thing, of course, is most people don't know what they want. Like they show up and they're like, what should I use? I don't know, fucking start anywhere. It doesn't even really matter because you start with something and you realize, is this the thing that tickles my noodle? And if it doesn't, then you move on to something else. You can try like five things, especially early on in your career. I would not at all be in a rush to commit. Like you just start programming? Oh, that's great. You should try five things. Once you've tried the five things, as we talked about in the beginning, the world isn't that large. You will realize that you've had some cursory understanding and that some things speak more to you than other things. Wonderful. Then double down. Then get good. Then achieve mastery. Then do all the things. But don't try to get it all together. We don't want one language. We don't want one. And that's why the internet is so amazing. This is why I'm like, it's weird, but it feels like the internet needs articulation of its defense because we've taken the internet for granted for a long time. And then suddenly these other programming languages or platforms, I should say, showed up like mobile, native. Good luck if you don't run or write Swift or Objective-C and you want to make apps for iOS. Now, it's possible. There's React Native. There's a bunch of other things you can sort of kind of do it, but you'll do it as a second tier or third tier citizen. If you want to be a first tier citizen, all paid up, get access to the latest, you damn well better use whatever Apple tells you to use. And it's the same thing in the Android camp. It's not the same thing on the internet. You can literally use whatever the fuck you want on the internet. I can get that Commodore 64 with 1 megahertz to reply to an HTTP response. Now, I don't know if I want to implement HTTP 2, but HTTP 1.1, yep, could do it on a Commodore 64. That's fucking amazing. And that's why I can still use Ruby and feel like I'm a first tier citizen on the internet. Wonderful.
I wanted to just, I know Prime wants to talk about JavaScript really bad. He's pretty much been like bouncing up and down the whole time, just ready to talk about JavaScript. But I'll just interject for one moment. What you're referring to is GNU. No, I'm sorry. This is just... the thing I wanted to say is, like, it, a great example of two projects where there is a fork and they live together nicely and have different visions is Vim and NeoVim. Like, NeoVim had a different vision for what they wanted, but we still contribute back and forth. We still send patches to Vim. We still, like, sort of, I guess, downstream their patches back into NeoVim. Like, it's a very nice, harmonious relationship, and they just have different visions. And that, like, should be okay. Maybe in the YouTube comment sections, maybe they're not okay with it, but what can you do? They're always going to be mad about something. But, like, those different visions can complement each other, and I think that's a really beautiful thing about open source.
Yes, and I think this is where the competition lens often comes up short. So much of programming commentary is done through a competition lens, like which is gaining which advantage and so on, when we can just go like, do you know what? There's a lot of advancements we can make for how to make web applications, for example, just conceptual understandings and how to do it better and how to do it simpler that can be applied to a million different ecosystems. And I look at something like Elixir or Laravel or some of the others that came after Rails, where I can go like, do you know what? I smile when I see some of the Rails-isms in that. And then they have other things, a part of it, that they come up with something novel and they do something else. And I can look at that and go like, oh, well, that's also a good idea. I don't have this sense like, oh, I need to smash it. Like, I need to own it. I need to dominate it. I need to capture the full market share of things. And this is one of the reasons why I wrote about this a while back. I don't want to be paid to do open source. Like, I fully understand that there are some contexts where that can work out, and that's fine. But I also think that as soon as you introduce the capitalist ethos into it, and I am a capitalist through and through when it comes to my actual capital and my actual business, so it's not like some communist plea here, but that there's an opportunity for open source for some people to exist outside of that realm, and I don't have to then be on market dynamics. Now, they still exist, and you can't ignore them fully, but like, I don't got to smash everything. I don't got to conquer everything. I don't got to beat everything. I don't have to capture all the users. I'm fucking running a show here, and you can come see it if you want, or you cannot see it if you don't want. Either is good, either is fine. I'm not like making it up on the ticket sales. So when you have that attitude to it, you can look at something. And this has gotten easier for me over the years. As I said, I went through some early years where I thought like everyone should just learn to appreciate Ruby, and then they'll realize it's the one true language. After I got out of that, just realizing, do you know what? This is great, because again, the main purpose here is to ignite the excitement for competence and depth and just joy in programmers. And if someone can see that spark light up in their little brain doing Elixir or Laravel or Perl or Python or Go, oh my God, that's great. That's great. Let's share some of the toys. Let's share some of the insights while not giving up on what we have. So this is the other thing too. In a large degree, this embrace of plurality means that within your project and your domain, you can go, do you know what? We don't have to be all this other stuff because we don't have to appeal to everyone. To me, the most potent example of this is static typing. Static typing is the one thing I will literally die on the hill for Ruby. We're not fucking putting static typing into Ruby. There are a million other statically typed languages out there. There's a bunch who, in my opinion, sadly, went that route when they had a beautiful dynamic language and then they turned it into a copycat of a static language. Like, ugh, I'm sorry about that for you. But if that's what floats your boat, wonderful. Go forth and be prosperous. Ruby? No. No fucking way. No. We're not doing that. There's so many other choices. We don't have to do that. We can go like, here's an environment. Here's an ecosystem. We believe these five things. Here's another choice that believes the opposite of those. The fact that the opposite exists is what gives you the permission to be truly you, right? Like, the choice is there. You can do whatever you want versus, again, the contrast here is something like the App Store, right? Like, oh, I want to put my app on an iPhone and I want to do it in a different way. No, you can't. Like, there's literally just one gate to go through. Okay, then you can get on the fucking barricades. Then you can get your pitchforks out and then we can overthrow the regime. That's fine. I'll sign up for that. But in open source, when there are literally a billion choices and, as you say, you're one fork click away from starting an alternative, no.
So you got to help me reconcile then. I would think you would then praise TypeScript. Hold me out. I know I'm going. We're going a little crazy here because it actually allows JavaScript to have a duality in nature. Those that love the, say, typing masturbation, as I like to refer to it as, they can do it all day long. And then those who just want to remain in the dynamic world can just be JavaScript. Wouldn't that be a benefit of an ecosystem that can actually large tent everybody in?
Yes, if it if that was the happy kumbaya atmosphere of the debate within the JavaScript community, I think that would be wonderful. That's not what I've been seeing. I've been seeing, especially on the TypeScript side, I mean, not just seeing, experiencing the kind of crusades that are launched from the TypeScript high tower, right? Like literally we went through with Turbo, people opening like bullshit PRs to remove things because what savages are we? What unbelievers are we if we don't accept the true TypeScript into our hearts? And that's the problem I have. I don't fucking care. If you want to write TypeScript, great. Again, goes back to our discussion. If that's the thing that floats your boat, wonderful. Don't fucking ram it down my throat. Like, I'm not going to run TypeScript in my projects, and I'm going to work towards a TypeScript-free future as an alternative, as one path. You can choose the fork here, right? Like, I'm big on no build, and TypeScript doesn't fit within no build because it's got to be built. Like, maybe, I mean, I hope not, sort of, kind of, maybe I fucking hope, I don't know, that, like, I was going to say, I hope that browsers don't adopt it. I'm actually fine. Actually, better than fine. I would love for TypeScript to be possible in a no-build world. Like, that sounds great. You like TypeScript? Great. You still get to enjoy no-build? Woohoo! Wonderful. But for me, living in the reality we have right now, no-build implies no TypeScript. Now, again, it's not exactly a great loss for me. I don't like TypeScript at all to begin with. But that's where sort of it drives up, right? So it's when we have this kind of discourse, what I really get most, I was about to say fired up, but that used to be true. Now I just get amused. I get amused by people who will look at literal fucking reality, like the fact that we're running Hey.com, $1 million ARR business, serving email to tens of thousands of happy customers on a no-build setup, and they'll go like, yeah, that doesn't work. Like, what do you mean it doesn't fucking work? We've been running it for 4 goddamn years. Like, I've literally accumulated millions of dollars from the things that doesn't work. What do you mean it doesn't work? It's like pointing to a fucking swan. You see it flapping its air, flying across, and you go like, yeah, physics say that doesn't work. I actually have a study saying that swans really can't fly. So I don't know what you're seeing, but your fucking lying eyes are lying to you. Swans can't fly. I have the paper right here, and it's got them peer-reviewed. What? Look at... Observe reality. Observe reality and realize if you just go, all swans are white, and there's one fucking black swan, then all swans are not white, right? Like, take your preposition and stick it somewhere. When we go, you go, no build is impossible. Or actually, it was even previous to no build. I mean, before the mind was fully blown for people, was just this idea of whether you had to bundle all your files into one entry point or not, right? Can you serve multiple files? And in our case, we're serving, I think for... Hey, we're serving 120 individual JavaScript files. And someone went like, yeah, that doesn't work. I'm like, first, again, exhibit flying swan. And then exhibit two, just fucking run the thing. You can just compare it right to left. And it works. It works great. In fact, it has greater caching dynamics on expiry, for example. You have all these little files that get to live forever because the vast majority of your code does not churn all the time. When you have one bundle, the entire bundle turns over every single time you change a goddamn semicolon anywhere, right? That's not great for caching dynamics. So we can have a nuance. We can just have a technical debate about the pros and cons of that. Totally great. Don't tell me the swan doesn't fly when I'm literally showing you that it does. And it's flapping in your goddamn face. That's the part that just gets me fired up.
I have to jump in. No, TJ, you don't get to interrupt me this time. No, there is a, because I was watching this no build thing. I actually, from your no build, I built a no build thing for a website. And I was like, oh man, I just love this. And I understand why no build got, like, why you couldn't do that at one point. Because in our younger years, you could only have two concurrent connections. Like, there was a real cost to having more than one file and all that. And that has largely gone away, but I noticed nobody talked about the completely amazing caching capabilities of no build. You are 100% right. 98% of your code base changes not ever. Like that's it. It just is a stagnant piece of something that just gets delivered with a new hash every week, and it's delivered with megabytes of JavaScript. And if you're on any remotely slow connection, if you're not from the Silicon Valley, it actually is a pain in the ass. You actually have this nice 1, 2, 3, 5 second wait, waiting for something just to show up. And yet you're getting just raked on the coals on that. How do you manage not to just eventually freak out on somebody just being like, you're just an idiot? Because look, like how do you remain calm? Because I've noticed a lot of your responses are more charitable. And often, even when directly getting dunked on, they're very charitable. Despite facts and science behind you, you still are being charitable. How does that how do you manage that in the 21st century?
The key ingredient actually is age. Once you grow old enough, you realize, like, fuck it. Like, what? I'm going to fucking piss match with someone on the goddamn internet. And the insight is, any discussion I have on, say, Twitter, I'm not just talking to that person. Like, there's a Colosseum here of people watching that. And if I just dump down in the mud and then we start just flinging, do you know what? That's going to have some short-term heat that is entertaining to watch. I mean, I'll get sucked into the train wreck of Twitter wars all the time. And you're just like, holy shit. And then afterwards, I'm always like, did I take anything away from that? Did I learn anything about those trade-offs? Did I appreciate anything about that? And I realize very often I don't. And I think, do you know what? What can I do to contribute less to that? And this sounds ironic, and I'll explain in a second. But how can I contribute less to that in the sense where if someone is watching, I'm at least planting a handful of seeds where, let's say, they're convinced that you have to bundle. And they hadn't really considered the caching argument. They hadn't considered big bundle that churns all the time versus small files where only a subset of them churn. You plant that seed in the moment, they're not going to hear it. They're not going to acknowledge it because it turns into a team sport. And then it's just about like who dunks harder and likes and whatever. But that seed will grow. If it's a good argument, and if you do have facts on your side, eventually that seed will grow. And maybe not next week, and maybe not the week after, but like a month later, someone will go like, oh yeah, actually I remember that thing. Let's just try it. Let's just try not to build or split it up, or use more files, whatever. Let's just try it and see. And then reality, if it's on your side, if you have a good argument, is actually going to be the thing that convinces people. Because what I've found is you can't actually convince most people most of the time in real time just with words. That doesn't work. Like the barricades we have on our brain to protect our ego and our good standing in our community, they're so effective that there are no argument, no set of words that I can write into a little Twitter prompt that can break through that in real time. It just doesn't happen. So the main thing you do is you can lobby those seeds over past the barricades, and then you can just wait. And I have found time and again, people who show up with the barricades and they're like, you're an idiot, you're wrong. I managed to land a seed. And then I talk to that person 6 months later and they go like, oh yeah, actually, that thing you said, we tried it. It worked. It panned out. Not always. It's not like it's full principle. Now, the other thing is too, it's just exposure. I was just talking about it. Like, I'm a parent. I have 3 kids. And I was talking to a new parent who's potty training their kid. And they were talking about, like, I never knew just how many bodily fluids I had to deal with, like, as you go through that process. And I go, like, yeah, you really get desensitized to that amount of literal shit and piss. And that is actually an amazing gift, right? And I'm thinking, this is, like, delusions of grandeur here. But this is what I'm imagining, like, a surgeon in a war zone. They're like, sir, you got to come over here. He's lost his leg. Yeah, 2 seconds. I got to sew up this arm that's missing. Right, like that person's not going to freak out over a leg, which most of us would just like, maybe we'd even faint seeing that, right? The exposure of just that much blood and whatever. Ugh. And then you don't have kids. You'd think it unthinkable to touch other people's literal shit, right? Like that sounds like what? Yeah, I have no amount of money can make me touch other people's poop, right? Like that's not a, and then you get a kid and you're like, yeah, I'm happy to do it. Well, I mean, that's an overstatement. I'm in the abstract happy to do it. No one is happy to, whatever. Anyway, That's what it feels like on Twitter. Like, once you've touched enough fucking sawed off body parts and some piss and shit, like, for long enough, you realize, yeah, that's just what this is. I have to accept that, like, that's what this channel is. And I've struggled more with that over the years than I have recently. Because I've also seen, what's the alternative? What is the alternative to sort of this free-form, often partisan, often stupid, open discourse style of argument is not that appealing. Like, whenever we go like, oh, if we could just have someone police it all, if we could somehow just, like, who knew what was correct and what was incorrect, and they could just take all the incorrect people and, like, put them somewhere, then we'd, like, have Nirvana. Yeah, no, that didn't work out so well, did it? Like, literally on every major issue over the past 5 years, there's been a consensus, or at least one consensus out of multiple, that sounds like an oxymoron, but I don't think it is, about what's right and what's wrong. And you realize, oh, yeah, that was wrong, right? Like, we didn't get it right. We didn't have all the facts. We didn't know all the things. And the only way we could progress towards more right, more correct, was to entertain some of all the wrong, because a lot of the wrong turned out to be right. Some of the wrong was wrong, and some of the right was wrong. But you sort of have to just accept some of this. And I think there is a way in here. I'm not saying that, like, literally everyone just throwing piss and shit on Twitter is, like, great, and we should just embrace that, and that we should be happy for that. But I accept some sliver of it, some degree of it. And then I also try just to do my part to play my example of, like, do you know what? I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to call you a retard on Twitter, even if I might think you're a retard, because that's just not what I do in a public forum, because, you know what, we can elevate things a little bit. I can think it. I can yell it at a fucking screen. I can go like, oh my God, I can't believe you're so fucking stupid. And then I can sit down for a second and go like, you know what, I don't have to tweet that. It could just, like, run around inside my little head. And you know what, after done 4 laps, I realize, first of all, the other party will think the same of me, that I'm the fucking retard. I will think the same of me in 2 years about at least a handful of topics. Holy shit, how are you so fucking stupid? That's fine. It can just stay in here, and then I can put forward sort of what I'd like to see more of. And now, the funny thing is, one of the most common criticism I get on Twitter is that, like, I'm engagement farming with my positions. As though, like, I'm literally coming up with no build as a way to troll the builders.
That can't be real. People are actually doing that.
Oh no. That's very real. That, like, the whole thing is like, whatever with Hay, it was a marketing scheme somehow. You're like,
you built an entire company and pipeline of engineers just to troll Twitter?
Exactly. That's where I just go like, holy shit, this is an amazing theory. This is an amazing lens in the world. Everyone who thinks something else than what I think, they're just doing it to troll people. You're like, I mean, I think it's amazing. I also think it's sad. I think it's a little bit like that dog that doesn't know anything. Like, you have to have a conception of the world where people can believe different things than you, and that doesn't make them insane, right? They can have different trade-offs. They can have different aesthetics. They can have different all sorts of things. Just because what to you looks controversial, this is what blows my mind. No build is not controversial to me. Cloud exit is not controversial to me. TypeScript, no thank you, is not controversial to me. Like, these are just the things I believe. These are just the things I'm doing. This is just how we're running our company. This is not some ruse. I'm not sitting down like, holy shit, do you know what I could spike the internet with today? I'm just doing my work. And then I'm sharing it and I'm shipping it. So that's the other thing about, like, the Swan, right? Like, Hay.com is an actual fucking business with actual fucking customers. So if no build was this disaster that couldn't work at all, and it was just a pile of shit, do you know how many customers we'd have? We'd have zero. Do you know how many customers we have? Tens of thousands. Like, this is not conceptually coherent as a way to think about other people's position. That, like, they're all just doing it for the trolling. They're also just doing it for this. No, I also want to make money. And the way you make money is you sell things that people want. At least some people, some of the time. If you're making just something that's so dumb that no one would ever buy it, yeah, you're not going to last that long. That's the other thing I have with this is I've been doing this for 20 plus years. And that, first of all, makes you sound old. But also, it also makes you sound like there's some stamina here. Like, I'm not in it for one Twitter slug. Like, we're just going to punch at each other for a little bit and like then I'm done, like I'm out. No, I gotta keep doing it. So if I go like, oh, no build, great. Yeah, I got to fucking work with that shit next year too when it's no longer a Twitter thing, right? So again, the cost-reward ratio here would be very off if these ideas and these approaches and directions were just about the ruse.
Yeah, I totally agree. I have another topic that's related to this, but first I just want to do a quick time check. I don't know how much longer you have to hang out with us and talk.
Oh, this is good. No, we can go for a bit further here. Let me just see if I have other stuff. No, don't. Let's just
okay. Sweet.
Keep it rolling.
Okay, because awesome. People want the general conception is this could go on for 5 hours and I would not be upset. So just so
maybe
you
not
know.
5 hours. Maybe not 5 hours. Yeah. But we can roll another until the top of the hour.
Oh, sweet. Okay, great. Okay. That'd be awesome. Because we'll probably talk maybe one, maybe two more topics, and then we'll start taking a few audience questions. So one of the things that you had said about sort of recognizing that your past self didn't understand something and then understanding it much better later that I really sort of like resonated with on a not technical but personal level is from your article about Children of You. Maybe you can sort of state, summarize what your position is about the feeling of having kids and the sort of life change experience it is. It's something that Prime and I have talked a lot about. So I just think it would be kind of fun to have sort of a non-technical side discussion about that aspect.
I think it's a great question and one with great weight, literally for the future of the world. But I also do think it has interesting, funny, sometimes hilarious parallels to technology. And I'll start with it in the sense that a lot of technology that's very popular, a lot what you will hear is all the reason people don't like it. Like if you go on some board and you look up some car model, like actually yesterday I was looking at an Alfa Romeo Giulia. And I was like, oh, I hear there's something about reliability issues, maybe. So I go on the boards, I search for it. And do you know what I find? I find a bunch of reliability issues. Because you know who fucking writes on the internet? People with problems. So that's what you see. You see people with problems outnumber the people who just go on with their merry life. Not just go on with their life, but loving it, right? Loving their Giulia in this example. Outnumber 10 to 1, 100 to 1, 1,000 to 1. I think that's a little bit what's been happening with parenthood. We have actually been inundated for I don't know how long with all the ways it's shitty to be a parent. It's fucking expensive and like how could you even do it to the climate and like all these other decel bullshit crazy ideas of how we could turn ourselves into extinction, right? Like all that, like that's been the prime thing because do you know what? That's now the people would just go like, do you know what? The laughter of my four-year-old is literally the most amazing sound that exists in this world. Most of those people don't go to Twitter to write that. Like, it sounds banal. And it sounds banal because it's so universally true that it feels like I don't need to say that, right? Yeah, right up until the 1,000-to-1 ratio has poisoned everyone's head into thinking that having kids is just this just insurmountable challenge. And I'm like, do you know how you fucking got onto this earth? There's literally like 5 million years of people who have it far worse than you who had to fight fucking literal saber tooths. If they didn't fight a saber tooth back then, you weren't here, right? Like that's your great whatever triple 50 times ancestor. So you're like fretting over the fact that like, I don't get as much free time to drink mimosas then. Like what? What? Like I wanna play some more Call of Duty, like on my free time. I think we need to correct that ratio somewhat by some testimony of just how goddamn amazing it is to literally create life from like stuff floating around like right below your boxers. Like that turns into this amazing kid who I would literally at any second with no hesitation sacrifice myself. Like, I don't have that level of devotion to any of my ideas, any of my creative pursuits, any of anything. I'd be like, you can't do Ruby on Rails tomorrow. I'd be like, oh man, that's a real bummer. Okay, I'll figure something else out. Like, you start questioning like the future of my children, and I'm like, yeah, I will nuke a billion people. Like, okay, where's the button? Like, if that's the trade-off here, that's what I'm going to do. Now, that sounds insane. And that is actually the appeal of parenthood. It is an embraced shared form of insanity. And insanity from the perspective of, like, I don't have kids. Because it sounds so far out and it's so hard to relate the elation, the life satisfaction that comes from having children, that it's almost like the other thing we talked about, like, it's actually difficult to use words. Because words can describe, like, the things you know. Oh, less free time for my mimosas and Call of Duty. Oh, I know that. I know mimosa. I know Call of Duty. Like, I can hold a controller. Trade it up against, like, literal life. Literal fucking life you created. You haven't created any other life. It's not like, oh, yeah, I was just doing some biohacking in my basement and came up with this mutant that was really cute. Like, that's not a sort of experience you've otherwise had, right? So you literally don't have a context to relate the words to. So when I say, like, I would sacrifice myself in a heartbeat for any of my children for almost any reason, like, that doesn't, it doesn't, like, it doesn't hit, right? Like, it doesn't go in there because there's no slot for that information to penetrate. Do you know what's interesting is I've had another topic where I've faced this, and this is about wealth. So I became a millionaire, like, pretty early in my life. I think 26, no, what was that? 27, something like that. And I had this conception that life was just going to be just a puffy cloud after that, right? Like, what the fuck you mean? I don't have to worry about any money of any kind. Oh man, I'm just floating on the cloud. Every day is amazing. Every minute is a feast. Everything is just... No, it wasn't, right? And then you realize it's better. Like, I'd rather be rich than I'd not be rich. But it's also not like the thing you think it is. But I can't use the words I have from that experience to tell you that. Because first of all, you can tell me I'm full of shit. It's just because you got yours and all these other things. And you can't actually conceptualize what life is like after that. It's a little bit the same thing. Now, the good thing is having children is far more accessible than becoming a millionaire. So it literally just requires you to find someone that hopefully you love, but at least that you can tolerate for, like, hopefully the rest of your life, or at least until those kids are older. Like, that's, I mean, the whole human race did that. Like, that's why you're here. That's why we're here. Like, the lineage, 100% hit ratio. 100% hit ratio all the way back to the dawn of man for you to be here. People did that, right? So don't tell me it's that hard. This is one of the things, techniques I often use to make myself learn something or realize something. Like, I'll, I don't know, try to learn how to surf. Like, surfing is actually kind of hard, like, the first time. And it takes a lot of, you get one shot, right, on the board. You fucking fall off, and now you got to swim all the way out to the wave, and you got to wave until the right wave. And I would often go, like, this is too hard. And then I'd go, like, in human history, how many people learned how to surf? It's got to be hundreds of thousands, maybe millions. Am I that stupid? Am I that uncoordinated that literally a million people could figure it out and I couldn't figure it out? And then I think about that with parenthood too. Like, how many people, like, what is it, 150 billion people have lived, or 100 billion people, or whatever it is. All of them figured out how to be a parent to varying degrees of success or capacity, whatever. But they did it, right? Like, that's why we're here. So 100 billion people, can I figure it out too? Yeah, I could probably figure it out. And then not just figuring it out, right? That's a mission statement. That's like, I need to solve a task. But once you have kids, like, again, it's so trite. And that's what's so amazing. Like, you want to say things like, it completes me. And, like, you'll actually, like, mean the words, which sounds so fucking stupid. I think I would have thought that before I had kids. But I just go, like, of all the things we could try in life, there's a lot of things you should try. You should try at some point to pull 3 G's. You know, it's really fun when, like, you barely can hold up your head, and you can try that in a race car. You can try that in a merry-go-round. You should try to, if we're talking to programmers here, you should try to, like, release a piece of open source, or at least submit a ticket to something. That's a life experience. You just go, like, your life will be richer afterwards. So take those little things, right? Like, try 3 G's, do a pull request. Create life. Like, where do you think it fucking ranks? Where do you think it ranks? It ranks, for most people, actually, through all of human history, number one. I mean, you have literal fucking conquerors who somehow enslave half the world, and they'd go like, yeah, I will die for my children. Like, that's what it is. And it's accessible, like, all the way down here. 100 million or 100 billion people did it. Like, you should do it too. So, huge endorsement of the idea that children are good and you should have them, even if it's for selfish reasons, which is what's so amazing. That even if you're like, I want to create a child because I want to create life in my image. It sounds like you're fucking God, right? So you do that. And then you realize in the act of doing that, almost anyone who goes through that process will become the most selfless person ever, that they've ever known in relationship to that new human. We just talked about the potty training, right? Mm-hmm. There is literally no amount of money you could pay me to pick up your shit. Like, you'd go like, you know what? Here's $1 billion. You just have to like assemble my excrements with your hands. I'd go like, keep the billion. Now, fair enough. Other people make a different choice there. But I'm not going to do that. Do you know what? For my kid, I'd say yuck, and I'm going to do it. I'm just selflessness, it sort of injects into your goddamn being, is next level. And I know some people have found that through LSD or whatever. Okay, great, I guess. But also, like, just make a fucking other human. Like, we need them. Like, if you all stop, there's literally not going to be anyone left. Like, that's a truism there. And, like, it's going to suck. It's going to suck. We should make more children. And all the ideas, the D-cell bullshit about, like, whether you even have the right to do it because climate, blah, blah. Take that shit out the back.
I think one of the things I relate to most when you're talking, so I have three kids. We just had our third kid like 2 months ago. So
I'm at four. I'm a winner.
Yeah, I know. Yes, you're beating me. I get it. But you're also way older than I am. So relax, okay? But when I was reading through this, one of the moments that I thought of was, and I've had this for each of my kids, but especially like when it happened to my firstborn, as I'm like rocking him at like 1 a.m. after he's been crying for a long time and all this stuff. And you like look down at them, and like, I have a great relationship with my parents. Like, we see each other all the time. They live right next to us. We moved back into town so we could be close to them, all of this stuff. Right. But then like looking down, I'm like, oh, like this is what my parents meant when they said they loved me. You know what I mean? Where like, I knew they loved me before. They've done so much for me. They sacrificed so much for me. They're not, but you're like looking down at your kid and you're like, oh
yes,
I didn't get that before.
Isn't it amazing?
Yeah.
Like, it's such a common experience. Like, it's not some sort of exotic thing. Like, literally everyone you've known has gone through it. And still, oh, that's what they meant. You couldn't actually know it through words. It's one of those experimental things where you have to be in that position to understand that truth. That's amazing. I am always just fascinated about the things where, like, I know I can't understand it unless I do it. And there's, again, on a much, much smaller scale, there's a lot of that around, right? But the creation of life and seeing yourself in an image is just so far up there. And the other thing I'd say with that is I didn't walk into the experience of being a parent or the desire to be a parent from, like, knowing all that. Like, I was actually a little hesitant, I will say. I was like, yeah, you know what? Yeah, maybe someday, whatever. Then I happened to meet the right woman who were like, no, like, we should do this. I was like, yeah, it sounds good, but like later. And she was like, what about now? And it was one of those things where, like, if I'd followed my own instincts and my own impulses, I would have literally made the biggest regret of my life. Like, I would have waited until it was too long. I have friends who did wait until it was too late. I don't know if it's literally too late, but like, it's not. Once you get past 40, for example, like, things get a lot harder and you have a lot less energy and whatever. And it's just like, wow, this is one of those things where I was just wrong. Like, I was wrong about the timing. I was wrong about the payoff, if you want to put it in that way. I was wrong about the magnitude of it. I was wrong about all my levels of comparison. Like, I would think about all the other things I'd done in my life. Oh, I really like that part. I like that part. And then you introduce this another thing where it's almost like you just change the y-axis of, like, meaning. And it just, oh, shit, I thought it stopped at 100, but it actually goes to 1,000. Oh, I didn't know. Wow, now there's a new dot up on the fucking graph here, all the way up in the corner, off the chart.
So So I heard a really great way to kind of visualize what you're saying, which is imagine you have a jar and it's just filled to the brim of ping pong balls. And someone comes to you and says, is this thing full? You would naturally say, this thing is full. And then they take Skittles and just start dumping them in. The Skittles just start filling it up. And they go, now, is this thing full? And you're like, well, of course it's full now. And he's like, sand. And just starts dumping sand in. You're just like, okay. I didn't realize how much room was left. And you can keep doing that. You can then add in water at the final, like the very, very end. You realize that there's a lot more room. And for me, it was the exact same thing. My mom always told me, I grew up super, super poor. So she always told me you would never be financially or emotionally ready to have kids. And she did not foresee that software engineering could actually make the common person have a decently good life. So that was not on her radar. That was even possible. But the rest was. And I still remember that where I thought I had a lot of care in my life. I thought I was full of all these things like big emotions and all this. And I could really, you know, I had a lot of command over my body and all this kind of stuff. And then I had a kid. And then it changed me drastically. I would not have been nearly the person I am with the desire to do things without like that requirement. Because for me, I didn't live up even to myself without that. So that's always my big kind of driving thing is that you just don't even know who you are until your life becomes in second place. Like when it's still in first place, it's really hard to really know yourself. Is when it goes to second place, you go, oh crap. Like I really have to think about things so much differently. Like when I'm at my job, is surfing Twitter okay? Well, maybe not. Maybe I really like, I'm in second place here. I got to like really focus on what I want to do, on how I want to accomplish it. What tasks do I do or don't do? And it's an extremely, it's the impossible thing to describe to somebody. I wish it was simple, but it's not. And not everybody wants to do it. I get it in our day and age. It's not even a requirement. Right? Like we live in a world where that's not even a thing. For most of history, you needed kids because like your joints started hurting and those saber tooths didn't kill themselves. So it's like, I need kids to like not die. And so it's like, we live in a different world now, but the value and the joy and all those things that are just hiding under the surface are still all there. And it's, I don't know. I get really pumped up about it just as someone who had both sides of a good and bad family.
Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say that what is so amazing to me when you look back upon history is we're living in a grand experiment. This experiment where it's no longer needed, right? It's no longer necessary. The saber tooth is not after you, at least in a literal sense. So you don't need to do it. So what happens when that pressure is no longer there? That is a fascinating experiment. And the closest parallel I can draw to that is art. You look at, the reason I call that post The Children of You was because I was making a parallel to The Children of Men, which is an amazing movie about what happens to the world when everyone goes infertile at once, where literally no new children appear in the world. That depiction was that everything falls to shit for perhaps exactly the reason that you're pointing out, that if you have an entire generation who are still in number one position, they have not yet moved into number two position, they don't have the same drive and instincts to maintain civilization in a good working order. This is also one of the reasons why classically, say, political leanings have a tendency to sometimes migrate once people go through that switch. Oh, I was used to be number one. There were certain things that really mattered to me. Now they're number two. Also things about like where you choose to live and all these things, right? That force, that was just nature pushing on us and we got it automatically. Now we have to choose it. I'm very curious to see how that movie turns out. I don't think it's going to turn out that great for the people who choose wrong. And again, this is also one of those things where the whole postmodern thinking, like there are no right choices, they're just different choices, and seeps into everything. This whole idea that the highest we have is just consent, right? Unless, if you affirmatively want to have children, like that's your right. And if you don't, you don't. And I get all that. Like that's what I've grown up in. That's what I've been marinated in. And I also then look at that like, yeah, I don't know how it's going to pan out. It's really interesting. Human history is full of these turns, very sharp turns. I've been reading this wonderful history about East Germany, about what happens after the World War II and how the country is divided and how Berlin is divided. And you're like, this happened 80 years ago? Like, there are people alive who went through that. And you read some of the concrete bits of it and go like, we have no fucking clue. No fucking clue which way the world is going to turn in 5 minutes, and we're running one of these grand experiments, like, let's just stop, have children. And I to some extent, like, I'm just fascinated to watch that show. And in another way, it also, like, I'd like to be, like, on the other side of it, reading the book about it, where we were like, we were done with that, and we went back to 2.1 plus. So anyway, I think this is also why it's good to have some of these crossing streams, that we're on a technical stream for programmers, and we're going like, do you know what? You should have kids. That's what you should do now. I think some of that encouragement is actually good. And I think we've lost some of that in this modern era of postmodernism, that every choice is equally valid and you just do whatever's right for you. We were just talking about that. Like, I'm actually on board with that in some ways. Like, that's that duality that fights inside your head. And like, do you know what? Maybe there are things that are just, like, good. Maybe there are higher virtues. Maybe there are things that we should push people somewhat towards pursuing, because it's going to be good for them and it's going to be good for all of us. Right, that's not a fully formed political theory in any shape or form.
Yeah, along with that, I think a lot of the sort of things that we've talked about as they apply to programming, like a quote that I really like was, meaningful problems are the most valuable human motivators, about finding problems at work and then, like, getting value out of that. But it's also sort of like, a more broadly speaking, like, it's a meaningful problem to, like, figure out how to be a good dad, and, like, that gives me a lot of motivation in my life. But I am getting told via the time, and also a great question from Lex, that we are about to transition into Top Shelf time. So that means if you are in Top Shelf in Prime's Discord, stop sending messages in Top Shelf, but just ask a question and then thumb up or thumb down them so that we can answer them. So don't type anything in here. We're going to delete the messages if it's not a question so that I can ask them to DHH. But we'll start off with our question from the Lex Friedman. Great conversation, Prime, Teej, and DHH. Question for all three. From your perspective as NeoVim users, welcome to the club, by the way, what to you are the biggest pros and cons of Cursor? Please don't kill me for this question. Laughing emoji in a donation message, too. Impressive to go for laughing emoji in a donation. P.S. See you later, Prime. Keep up the great work. That one was just from Lex to you, Prime. I just wanted to make sure you saw that. So
thank you.
So Cursor as the first sort of top shelf question.
You want me to go?
Yeah, we do.
Everybody already knows our opinions. I shout my opinions every day live. You're the one that's...
Yeah, all right. I'll set it up. And the setup is, I'm undecided. And I'm undecided in the sense that I like a lot of what AI has brought to the table. I feel like the projects I've done since AI has been available, I have enjoyed slightly more. And the fun thing about enjoying them slightly more is not that AI is writing my code. It is that AI is a superior Google, is a superior Stack Overflow, is a superior API doc, whatever. It's a superior way for me to get answers to the questions that I have in real time without all the work. It feels a little bit like we were talking earlier about what it was like learning programming for the internet. Do you know what? I'm sure some people look back upon that with some degree of nostalgia. I don't, because it didn't work for me. I didn't learn programming before the internet. It literally took the internet for me to learn programming. And part of that was that there was a Google or an Alta Vista before that, and you could search for things and you could find out, and other people had the same problems, and it was better and it was faster. I do not want to go back. I don't want to go back to the pre-internet age of programming. Even though I'm sure there was some cool shit going on and some wizards figured it out, I wasn't one of them. I wasn't part of that wizard club that could figure it out without the internet. So that setup is to say that, like, I enjoy AI as a better version of that. What I have not enjoyed is to have AI write my code. And I got a small taste of it in a recent project I did with Umacoop. Umacoop is my sort of remix, if you want to call it that, of Ubuntu, that sets up takes a fresh Ubuntu and turns it into a programming environment that I would like to use, that is literally what I do use. And I decided quite early on to write it all in Bash. And one of the reasons I wanted to write it all in Bash was Ruby could do this. Ruby's a great language for writing shell integrations and whatever. But I hadn't done that much Bash, and I was like, you know what? This seems like the right pressure. I don't want to do too much. This shouldn't just do everything. It should do just enough. Bash is the right language for installing packages and a few other things. It'll have the good constraints. And I was like, I'm not a Bash expert. So AI really helped me on early on, just like, oh, I want to write this. And I'd usually write a piece of Ruby, and then I'd ask for the Bash version. And I really liked that because of the initial speed up. But what I also found, what was so easy to keep the training wheels on. Like, I found myself asking AI the same question for the fourth time because I somehow had picked up on the fact that I didn't need to remember anything. And then I realized, you know what? I don't like that. Like, the training wheels are great when you're first learning to balance, but if you keep it on forever, you're never going to fucking find balance. You're never going to get the true understanding and so forth. So I have a very mixed relationship with it where I really enjoy it as a better Google, as a better Stack Overflow. I enjoy it even almost like as a sort of a pair programmer, AI pair programmer who doesn't drive, who's just there to give suggestions, to know the API, to do all these other things. But the second it starts wanting to autocomplete my code, I'm like, yeah, I'm out, bro. I like the code part. This is one of the reasons I like Vim. Like, these are manual text manipulation moments and movements, and I enjoy doing them. It's like saying, hey, you can play Street Fighter 2, but you could also just have a robot playing it for you and you could watch. Yeah, no, I want to fucking move the joystick, man. If I'm not making a Hadouken myself just timed right, like, what's the point? If I just have someone else playing for me, what's the point? Then the point is just the outcome. And that brings us back to my origin story of programming. I have basically two phases of my programming life. One that was just focused on outcomes. I wanted programs, and whatever the fuck I had to do to get that, I would do that. And then I had the second phase, post-Ruby, where I enjoyed making programs, like for its own sake. I'm still in that phase. I'm not fucking handing that over to AI. That's the part I enjoy the most, to some extent. Like, I want to do the typing. I want to do the fucking combo moves. I want to feel like I'm the one who's in charge here. And maybe there's some nostalgia here, and that's totally fine, too. Again, maybe like I'll tell the story in like 5 years when AI has taken over everything. Like, I got to program while we still had to do it manually. And I, like, great. Amazing. Like, I'd also like to still have a horse if I was into horses, even though there were cars around, right? I can accept that progress may render what I do either irrelevant or just not the vanguard of economic activity. Like, it can stop being a profitable economic activity for me to pull off sick BIM combos. Like, I can accept that, right? That might not be something that the market wants to pay me to do anymore. I'm still going to fucking do it. Like, why do you think people are still programming that Commodore 64 1 megahertz machine? Because they're trying to... No, because they enjoy doing it. Because they enjoy the challenge. They have a meaningful obstacle in their way, and I want that meaningful obstacle, and it's not fucking prompt engineering. It's not. Now, the other thing is, this might not work. I know there's literally like fucking 5 trillion pouring into AI, and some very impressive shit has come out of it, but it may also not work. Like, we may literally never get to the promised land. We don't even understand how the current AI works. Like, I've listened to a bunch of interviews from all the fucking smart people who are working on this. And like half the time they're like, yeah, like there's a minus one here and it connects to the plus one there. And like, I don't fucking know why that produces a new version of Shakespeare. But like, that's just what it does. So we are a little bit in this magical space where we just don't know. There are a bunch of people who are totally convinced, in much the same way that Elon Musk, I'm sure, very genuinely believed in the middle of 2017 that by the end of the year, people's Model S's would just be driving around and, just going to turn up the light here, would drive around and make them money. That didn't happen, but maybe it will next year. It's possible, right? I remember, I've given this example many times. I remember watching The Lawnmower Man. I don't know if either of you two have watched that. The Lawnmower Man was a sort of a B movie about virtual reality that came out in 1995. It was... total shitty movie. But holy shit, the image of floating around in VR as being an avatar and you have the gloves on and you have the mask. I was like, this is fucking amazing. Like, in 5 minutes, this is going to be how I'm living. I'm going to be inside this thing. I'm going to be an avatar. I'm going to be. And then literally 20 years later, Zuckerberg plows in $40 billion into that. Like, that's going to happen. It's going to happen. And like, what, 5 people and a dog showed up? Like, no one wanted that to happen. VR has literally not happened. There's a bunch of people playing Beat Saber, and that's fun. But like this Lawnmower Man reality of us all floating around in VR, no one wanted that. I don't want to fucking look at your weird ass Uncanny Valley Apple ski mask avatar thing that like correctly simulates the moving of my eyebrow. I'm like, no. And so does no one else. That fucking thing bombed harder than, let me not make a parallel. It bombed, right? Now, again, lots of things bomb, and then you give them 5 years, then you give them 10 years, and it works. You just don't fucking know. You don't know. You can't tell because no one knows anything. No one can predict like what's going to happen, what's going to be reality. That's what I find so wonderful about AI. It has such bright promise that is actually obvious to almost anyone who uses it. Like, I've not found yet a person who've actually used AI who weren't at least slightly impressed. We can make computers do that. Sick. But also, is it going to rewrite society? Maybe. For as long as I can, I'm going to write manual code. I'm going to fucking pull up my Vim combos, and I'm going to tweet about how excited I am for discovering a new one. And I'm going to just enjoy that. And maybe there's 5 years left of that. Okay, great. I will enjoy those last 5 years. Actually, it won't even just be the next 5 years, because I'll also do the 5 years after that, right? And the other 40. I will continue to write programming just because I really like it. Just like I continue to play fucking Street Fighter with my kids because it's fun, even though a bot could do it better than I could.
That is so dang good. And a lot of that mirrors kind of my similar feelings, which is a lot of the reasons why I program is because I want to program. I like the experience. And there's, you know, it doesn't happen as often these days just because I, you know, I'm not saying I happen to know everything, but I just know so much that when I see a problem, I can see how it should just generally be outlined. And so I can just kind of start flying on the keyboard, start doing it. But every now and then you like see something from a new perspective like that, almost like you get like forced epiphany, just like land on you. You're just like, oh, that is so incredible. Oh my gosh. Because that's like the thing that got me more excited than anything else in programming was learning how linked lists work. The fact that a linked list could reference itself and you could all of a sudden you could just see it shoot out into memory. And you're just like, oh my gosh, like that's, oh, like that's really neat. Like, oh my gosh, this is the neatest thing I've ever seen in my lifetime. And I still remember that as being probably the most consequential moment in all of programming. And it's really the reason why I've continued to keep doing it. And I do see from the top shelf, people are asking, what is kind of like, do you have that consequential moment that made you turn from, like, oh, I like programming into like, whoa, like kind of hit with that epiphany or some moment that's like, I will do this now from here on out.
Oh, it's crystal clear. Discovering metaprogramming in Ruby. Discovering how I could make active record. For those who don't know, I'll type it out literally through my mouth because it's so simple. Class, person, less than active record base. All right, now we've declared our class. Next line, has underscore many space colon comments end. Like that's a class. Like that's an active record class that has a one to many relationship with another class called comments, and it'll wire it all up with the database so you can pull it straight out. Holy shitballs. When I found out like that I could do that, that I could write DSLs, that I could write these domain specific languages, and like I would just I'm imagining in my head, this is what's so great about nostalgia from 10, 20 years ago. You can just rewrite it such that the movie gets better. Like I'm imagining like by putting up my hands, looking at the hands, I did this, right? Like just a sense of power that like, this doesn't even look like a program. Like how am I doing this? And then thinking, do you know what? I could build a whole framework that's just like this all the time where we're just flowing through things through metaprogramming. So finding that metaprogramming in Ruby was probably, if I was to pinpoint one tipping point, that was it. That I could do that myself. That it wasn't something a language designer had to do. It wasn't something that Gosling had to put into Java to allow me, the little peon, to be able to do it. No, I could write at the same level of expression as fucking Mats, who designed the language. You could not tell apart that class statement from my has many statement. They both just looked like they were keywords. Holy shit. I was hooked.
I had a similar thing. It's kind of metaprogramming, but like with a space in between instead of the concept, where I found out when I was in college that like this new NeoVim project was coming out, and I was blown away that people could like write code and it could change what happened in their editor. right? So I was like writing code to change how I programmed, and I was like, this is awesome. Like, my only experience before this was like Eclipse, you know, in the computer lab, right? Like, I grew up very, no one in my family knew computers, anything like this, right? So it's like, oh, I guess programming's always just an Eclipse, and like sometimes it just crashes, you know? And you're like, oh my goodness, wait, I can take all the skills that I know about writing software to solve problems, and I can just solve my own problems. And I was like, mind blown. I am in love.
It's incredible. And I think that's that is that dopamine tipping point, mm-hmm. that I try to find as many invitations as I possibly can to stick them into Ruby on Rails. So people can find that like golden Willy Wonka ticket in like 500 different places. And there's an unlimited number of golden tickets. An unlimited number of tickets where if you find the one and you get the aha moment and you get the dopamine hit, you're going to be in. You're going to be hooked, right? Like, because I kind of was, I don't know if I was bumped. That's not true. I like everything the way it has happened. Amor fati. I don't want anything different. But I recognize that I was programming for literally like at least 2 years, maybe 3 years before that moment. And that was a very different type of programming. It was not this stuff we're talking about here. So I'd be like, do you know what? Would have been nice to have that happen in the first week. What can we do so some more programmers in their first week or first month or first quarter get a Willy Wonka ticket to exactly what the three of us are talking about? That experience of like, holy shit, I have the magic in my fingers and I can make the silicon dance to my liking. That is an incredible addictive sense of power that sends most people, I think, who've experienced it down this rabbit hole of expertise and competence.
Speaking of dopamine hits, someone asks, Sus, user Sus, of course, in Prime's Discord, but how did you get into racing and like why racing?
Good question. I always liked racing video games. The one that stands out most to me is actually on the Dreamcast called Metropolitan Street Racer. I think it's from 1999. That was the first racing game that to me felt close enough to the idea I had in my head of what real driving was like and developing the expertise of sliding a car into one. Now, what's funny is it literally took me 6 more years to get a driver's license. I grew up in Copenhagen, Denmark. I did not have a car or a driver's license until I was 25. I got around the city on literal fucking rollerblades. I kid you not. That was my main mode of transportation growing up. I would rollerblade to high school and so forth. It was just a great way to get around a very walkable city, small city. You didn't need a car. Anyway, at 25, I get a driver's license because I wanted to travel to the U.S. And I'd heard, like, you're kind of screwed if you get to the U.S. and you don't know how to drive a car. You're not going to get very far. So I get my driver's license, and then I ended up moving to the U.S. as part of joining 37 Signals just like 7 months later or something like that. Got my first car, an Audi S4, which was this amazing experience. I landed, and then Jason, my business partner, was like, all right, you got to get a car. And I was like, okay, cool, let's go to the dealership. And from Denmark, I like had picked out this very sensible Audi S3, which is this hatchback, or not S3, A3. Hatchback, sensible thing that could go to grocery store, whatever. We go there, I drive this car, and literally in that moment, I decide to spend my entire life savings. At that time, we were already making a little bit of money. I think I had like, I don't know, I think I literally had like $40,000 in the bank. And like, I just blew all of it on that Audi S4. So it's like literally almost $0 left in the bank. I just bought it outright. And that was a fun experience, which also resulted in me learning just a few days later that like, there's cops on the interstate. And like, they will actually pull you over if you... So not only did I get the experience with like American car culture quite quickly, I also got the experience with American Highway Patrol quite quickly. And I was like, this is like being in a fucking movie. I got this guy walking up at the side of the car, like his hand on his gun. And I got this other guy in my rearview mirror who also has his side of the gun. There's like sirens off. And I'm like halfway scared to death, halfway super excited. Like, I'm in a fucking movie. What's going to happen? I just ended up getting a ticket. So that was a lot of fun. And then 2 years later, a friend of mine took me to a racetrack. I literally just had my driver's license for 2 years. It took me to a racetrack. I sat in a real race car, like a Formula Mazda from early 90s, I think, which a manual shifter, single seater, all the stuff. It looked like a miniature Formula One car. And I go out on the track and I drive that around. And I come back in And I remember actually not being able to articulate. It was like if someone had like overclocked my CPU by like 3 times and then tried to like bolt on some cooling just to keep it together for long enough that I like wouldn't crash and just to come in. And I just went in and I was like, that was cool. Like, you know, that is an understatement of that was cool. That was fucking mind blowing to drive a car on a racetrack, a proper race car. And then I really got into it. And I spent every weekend for the next couple of years on just getting better at it, being at the track. And then towards end of the 2000, 2009 or whatever, Basecamp was doing well enough that I could do some of this stuff more seriously. I was like, do you know what? What's the biggest fucking race? What is the biggest fucking race I want to go to? Let's just set that the bar. And I was like, 24 Hours of Le Mans. The 24 Hours of Le Mans, which is this famous motor race in France that's been going for literally 100 years. I'm like, I want to do that. And then it became a mission. How do I get there as quickly as possible? So I just sort of got into that. Anyway, what's interesting for programmers to me is that there's so many similarities. You can think of a track as a clock cycle. Like you have one clock cycle around the track, right? And if you can optimize that, if you can do sort of more work, do more of the right thing, you go faster and you get immediate feedback. It's like doing micro benchmark optimizing, which can be quite fun, where you go like, oh, I just did another thing in that turn 11. I went 2/10 quicker. Let's try that again. Can I replicate that? Can I do more of that? How much do I have to do to get all the way down there? So that's fun. That's on an individual level. Then you zoom out to the team level and it's like a miniature company. Like at the kind of racing that I do, this company comes together at the start of a season. All of a sudden, there's like 25 people who kind of have to figure each other out and like who's full of shit and who knows their stuff and who do we need to replace? Like all this stuff, right? It's like doing a startup, but if you just compressed it down to like 6 months until the IPO, right? Like you have the whole thing. It's got to happen in 6 months, not a lot of time. It's a really fascinating way to get to know people and quickly suss out competence and all that stuff. So I draw a ton of parallels. I try to move a bunch of things I've learned about programming and running a business into the racing world. And I take a bunch of it back out again. And then it's also just hella fun. I mean, I picked that example of the 3 G's for a reason. You should try that once in your life. Like, it doesn't have to be you driving the car at 3 G's, but you should drive in a car where you're pulling over 2 G's. That's really the magic point for me. You can, in a street car, like a Tesla Model S, whatever, can accelerate in literally 1.1 G. And it feels crazy. It feels like sickening. A roller coaster, in some ways, you can get some G's to be in a fucking race car. Sit with your goddamn helmet on. Feel that suddenly your head is 3 times heavier than what it was before and that you can't hold it up because you don't have enough neck muscles. That's amazing. One of those peak life experiences I can highly recommend.
I've never heard someone recommend having your neck actually crashed by gravity. Like have an artificial hold up to keep it. Like, I would die. I'd be dead if this did happen.
That's why it's fun. Actually, that's a great point. Do you know what? It is the spice is that if you don't do it right, it's at least going to be expensive. It may very well hurt and you could legitimately die. Now, I don't want to die, but I want to know that I could. Like as a somewhat remote option, because that brings in just enough to like, I'm alive, right? Like there's just enough of like the taste of it. And I've had some crashes that weren't great. Most of them have just been expensive, not that painful. But I've also seen it go wrong. And again, that's not a glorification of death per se. Like there's a bunch of things. I think those squirrel suits, you know, those one where they jump off a cliff. That looks like the most amazing thing ever that I would absolutely goddamn love to do, but the mortality rate is 1 in 10. Yeah, no, I can't take those odds. Like literally 1 out of 10 who do the squirrel thing on a regular basis crash into a mountain and they die. That's how racing used to be. If you were a Formula One racer in the 60s, I think the mortality rate in the 60s was 17% or something. Like 17% of the people who started the grid didn't make it to the end of the year because you crashed one of those old cars and it burst into a ball of flames and you were going to die or at least get disfigured. No, thank you. I like just a little bit. It's kind of like a seasoning, right? Like you can have a bland meal and like I like a little bit of sriracha on it. Don't fucking jam in a goddamn whole chili pepper. That's going to spoil it for me too much. But a little bit of spice. And race car driving has just enough of that where you go like, I'm in contact with something that is 5 steps removed from the saber tooth, but like I can squint and imagine that there's a little bit there that like I actually do have to run, otherwise I will get eaten. I like that. That's good.
That was so good. I like this idea of just a little bit of death. Just a sprinkling, spritzing, really. All right, so I have a great question, and I know our time is running to an end, so you can answer this one pretty quickly. And I think this is a good one and some good advice you can give to a lot of people, because I know a good 20%-ish of the audience is in that new grad to just trying to get hired phase. And so what do you see as the biggest problem, or what's the biggest problem you see with new hires in programming right now?
Oh, that's a good one. Well, before you even get to that step, if you're applying to a lot of openings and you're using AI to write those cover letters and whatever, realize that so are a bunch of other idiots. And what someone who receives a lot of those see is all of it. And it smells the same, and it looks the same. I can tell when
Certainly.
The AI wrote your thing, because it uses the same phrases and the same setup as all the other ones. So you look like you look very smart when you think you're just looking at your cover letter, right? You wrote whatever version you wrote, and then AI made it better. Well, realize that when I receive it, there's another fucking 50 people who did the same thing, and it looks like slob. Even though it looks better, it's slob. So that doesn't work. I would highly discourage that. Maybe AI is going to be amazing tomorrow and can do it in a way where I can't even tell. Entirely possible. Today, no. So don't do that. That would be step one. The other step would be just get involved with something, anything. When I'm hiring a junior programmer, you're not hiring on accomplishments. You're hiring on promise. And you need to see the sparkle somewhere. Somewhere there's got to be a sparkle. Sometimes that is a pull request to an open source thing. Sometimes it's a thing you did on your own. Sometimes it's a cheat sheet that's very nicely formulated. Sometimes it's something, right? Like it's very hard to actually quantify, because exactly the problem is you can't look at track record. That's juniors don't have track record, right? Otherwise they wouldn't be juniors. So you have to look at the sparkle. So you got to find, I mean, that's very fucking vague. Is that even actionable? I don't even know if it is. Actually, let me put it a different way. Commit to becoming good. Commit to be not the fucking dog that doesn't know shit. Commit to like, I will figure things out and it'll take me a long time in the beginning, but I will drill down and I'll figure it out. That will be the one thing I will say from actually having hired some juniors, wherever the sparkle was, what to me made them stick and us thinking it was a good hire were people who were willing to do that. Like they didn't know everything. Again, that's why they're juniors. But they were willing to find out. They were willing to peel back the onion until they got to the part that was brown, until they got to the part that didn't work and needed to be cut out. That, I think, is actually something that may atrophy with AI. And again, maybe we're worried about fucking bicycles because it turns, what was it? It turns young people crazy. That was one of the things about bicycles. Or books are dangerous because, like, I've been through multiple rounds of this, right? So be a little self-aware there. But just, don't give up on this thing. You're going to figure things out. And try to reflect that. I think actually bug reports is another good way. Even if you can't fix the issue you're finding in open source piece of software, I can see a lot of sparkle in a great bug report. Someone who could reduce the issue that they found into the smallest reproducible element of that. That's more about thinking. That's more about your analytical process. Doesn't rely on track record, doesn't rely on super expertise in some particular framework. So find a way to exhibit that quality. And then just be good. This is, I get this all the time. So for the last hiring round we did, we got 1,500 applications, right? And we had to reject most of them. Obviously, that's how it works when you get 15. We can't hire 1,500 people. We're 60. We can't hire 1,500 people. And a lot of people wanted to know why, right? Why did I not progress? Well, first of all, just think about the mechanic. Like, that's actually a trick question in itself. Anyone who asks, like, why can't I get a detailed response from you as to why I didn't progress, haven't done the basic math of thinking 1,500 people times 5 minutes is 7,500 minutes is 3 fucking weeks of nonstop 8 hours a day writing feedback to all applicants back. No, that was a hiring question and you just failed that one. But even beyond that, I can't tell you. I can just tell you that the best person progressed. You just got to be good. And this is such a frustrating answer because you're like, well, then I want to be good. Yeah, okay, then you got to be competent. Oh, well, how do I become competent? Well, let me show you. Here's a 10-year career path to discovering that. But there's no shortcuts. And I think this is often what's behind the question. People are looking for a shortcut. How can I, like, not do any work but still get the job? Yeah, that's going to be hard, buddy.
Dang, that's real. I can't tell you, like,
but
I've had this problem where it's like, I want to produce things. And I think a lot of people feel this exact same thing. And I think this is where a lot of people are putting a bunch of bank on AI, which is there's two forms of operation. There's one, the operation of learning the thing for the sake of learning the thing. And there's the second operation of building something to get it out there for people to use. And often they can come at, like, they can come highly tensioned, as we all know, that sometimes you just have to get the thing out there without learning about it. And luckily in my older years, I've had more time of spending learning and all that. But in my younger years, it was all about producing the thing. And I feel like this is such a hard balance. And how do you convince people where to kind of put that? Because I do think building something just to understand is worth a ton and it can do wonders for your career. But in the immediate, it's really not beneficial. It's, you know, like no one's sitting there going, oh, wow, I can't believe you know how HTTP 1.1 works, right? Like no one's going to pat you on the back for that. But it can be that one little thing that you start talking about in an interview that completely changes their perception of you. And it's so funny, like how do you convince people that this type of thinking is actually maybe longer term the better kind of thinking?
It's difficult, and sometimes I think you need to just get some hard knocks of life, or some rejections and whatever, to realize that whatever strategy you're on isn't working and you should change. This is one of the things I've seen. For example, we require cover letters, and we require cover letters that are about this job at our company, which requires you to actually write something specific to this opening. And I've heard some pushback on that is like, yeah, but I'm not going to spend a lot of time on your job opening. I have to apply to 100 jobs to what? What, you're going to put even less effort into even more jobs? Yeah, how's that going to work out? It's not going to work out, right? So sometimes the cynicism seeps in because you've had some experiences you think are bad experiences. You've applied to 20 jobs and you didn't get a call back. You didn't get, okay, yeah, that fucking happens. It does. It's not going to get better by you putting in less effort, by doing less presentation to be competent and sparkling, right? Like, there's going to be less of that to happen. And again, it is one of those hard things where it's not actionable because there's not a trick. I can't tell you the one thing to do. You got to be smart and you got to get things done. That gets to your point, right? There are smart people who don't get things done. Do you know what? They're also not that useful for commercial software building. But there are also people who get things done and who aren't that smart or who aren't applying techniques or who don't understand things. Do you know what? Maybe that works in some scenarios. It doesn't work at our company. Like, I have to look at your code, perhaps probably after you're gone. I've been here since day one, and I will probably be here after you're gone. And I have to look at the code. I have to go back and look at it. So I'm only going to hire people whose code I want to look at again in 5 years, right? Again, it doesn't have to be that they write perfect code, but they're on a trajectory that at least have the aspirations of writing beautiful, nice code that I could want to maintain in 10 years. That includes myself. I try to hold myself to all these standards that I ask of others. But yeah, there's no trick. And that's really disappointing because wouldn't it be nice if there was? But that's just not how it works. You got to be good and you got to be on a trajectory of good. You got to show some sparkle. And that's about as specific as it gets. Unfortunately.
Yeah. Just to echo what you said, for me, getting my first remote job before I was like known in open source and some other stuff like this was primarily because I was volunteering on Friday nights. And like, I had a fun story that talked about that. And that was how I got through the inundation of like online resumes, was I wrote a particular cover letter that matched with the values of the company. I gave them specific actionable real life examples of what I did to do, like that I was living out those same things. And then they gave this random guy from the Midwest a call to interview. And then one thing led to the other and I've got my first remote job. So I definitely want to echo, like, there's other things you can do. Make yourself an individual, not just like you're saying, a ChatGPT rapper. don't be a ChatGPT rapper. So I don't know if there's anything else you want to like plug.
I do want to bring one point because I just said there's no cheat codes, and I don't actually think that's true. I do think open source is a cheat code.
Yeah.
I do think open source is a cheat code. And that doesn't mean that everyone has to have, we have a lot of programmers who don't have a long, whatever, CV of open source contributions. It's not a requirement, but it is a cheat code. If you're junior and you're able to do something in open source that I can see prior, you absolutely have a leg up. You absolutely have an advantage. Because the thing with junior, again, is you can't look at a large sort of CV that has all these prestigious placements. You can look at some code. And this relates to my own experience of wanting to fail math in high school. The reason I wanted to fail math in high school was not because I wanted to fail math. I actually kind of like math. I'm not that great at it, but like I do like it. It was I wanted to spend my time on different things. I spent my time working on the internet. I spent my time building gaming websites and all these other things. So I think sometimes people who are perhaps in college or whatever, they think like they have their coursework. That's important. But also, it's also you could also get a cheat code, a leg up by doing some open source. And even if it means failing a couple of classes, I don't fucking look at any grades when I hire people. Maybe they do other places and that's not universal advice. But I will look at open source contributions before virtually everything else. Again, doesn't mean it's a requirement. It just means it's a cheat code. You can absolutely get ahead of the line by having some great open source out there where people can review exactly your lines of code and contribution.
Yeah, it also helps you learn how to work with people and communicate and a bunch of other stuff. I learned a lot from that. So I'll also echo that. But I think we're just about at the end of our time. DHH, thank you for being here. Anything you'd like to plug? I know there's some maybe Rails things happening or anything else you'd like to sort of give as a last shout out. We really appreciate you taking the time to come chat with us.
Yeah, no, this has been really fun. I really enjoyed it, especially the whole thing about kids as well. I think it's always fun to pull some of those things. Plugging things, I mean, I am assuming that all your chat folks are already Linux geeks, but if they're not, I'd actually say that is, I don't know if it's a cheat code. It is a nice or workaround to understanding servers better is to run Linux on your own laptop. So if you aren't already doing that, and again, I wrote a blog post in 2005 that was one of my early controversies. And the controversy was I said I wouldn't hire a Windows person. Because at the time, I was like, you know what? Windows is so far removed from this open source ecosystem that I'm in. I can't see how someone who's in there is going to do well. I think that was misjudged. And I've worked with plenty of people who started out on Windows and whatever. But all that said, like right now, do you know what the vanilla AI wrapper of computing is in web circles? It's having a Mac. And again, that's not something bad about the Mac. It's just like, that is not a differentiating experience. Do you know what is a differentiating experience? If you run Linux. And that's just a virtue of it being the path less taken. Like you can get a leg up, you can show others that you're willing to do things that is not as common, it is harder, perhaps, than it would be elsewhere. So I would actually recommend that. I mean, this is coming with all the credibility of a newly formed vegan. Like, oh, I just turned to veganism. Let me tell you all about why you shouldn't eat animals for the next 2 years. I have some of that in me since switching to Linux full time is still relatively recent. But yeah, I would encourage that. I have my own project for that. That's omakub, omakub.org. For that, but otherwise,
I've linked the tweet
on phh.dk. And we're going to do Rails World next week, and I'm going to talk about a lot of the things that we talked about today, no build and other things, deployment, cloud. We didn't even touch on cloud. It's going to be a lot of that in next week's keynote, and Rails 8, which we're going to push out. So that's all the plugs I can fit in.
I actually wanted to talk more about NeoVim and more about the cloud, because that one is very, very interesting. But alas, time
have you back.
Yeah. Anytime you want to come back, you want to talk about those things, plug those things, let us know.
Yeah. And I would be remiss if we didn't say we talked about how it was really important to have kids. So if you're exploring Linux, do not use Arch Linux. Try a different kind of operating system so that you're still able to pursue sort of both avenues at the same time. I just wanted to make sure that's out there as a closing word. Thanks. Thanks, DHH.
It is fathers against Arch Linux. Foul, right?
All right, see everybody. Again. Thank you.
Later.
Thank you. Thanks, DHH. That was awesome. All right, bye, DJ.
Did you just kick him out or did he leave?
He left.
Okay, I thought you just like booted him. You're like, see ya, loser, and then just made him go.
I would never do that. I just recorded your response to that. It's going as the outro, and the name is, see how much of a jerk TJ is? I'm so nice.
True.
A Jen.